This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Rolf Moet Larsen is a former career CIA officer. He spent most of his career working on the Soviet Union and Russia, including serving multiple stints in Moscow. He also served as a head of the intelligence office at the Department of Energy. Rolf has been on our show many times before, and today he joins us for a very special discussion. We'll be right back with that conversation after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Rolf, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you back on Intelligence Matters.
Well, Michael, it's good to be on the new Intelligence Matters and talk to you once again. I've enjoyed our conversations in the past.
Rolf, I want to start by explaining to our listeners what we're going to do today, because it's a bit different than what we've done in the past. You and I are part of a special email group where we share everything from interesting things we've read on national security issues to pretty intense discussions about, you know, who are the best quarterbacks in the NFL and who are the best potential NFL quarterbacks who are currently in college. We won't tell folks, Rolf, who was on that email group. That will remain a state secret here today on the podcast. I do want listeners to know, however, that you often on this email group share anecdotes that I believe provide real insight into a number of different issues. But the leading issue that your stories help illuminate is the Russian mindset, how they think about the world, how they think about their country's place in it, and how they even think about themselves. And what we're going to do today is I'm going to ask you to tell some of those stories. And then at the end of each story, we'll have a conversation about what does that story tell us about the Russian mindset? So with that, let's jump right in. And Rolf, I want to start with a puppet show that you took your family to during the early days of your first tour in Moscow. Can you share that story with us?
Yes, Michael. And I wanted to proceed maybe to explain any anecdote or analysis I would offer on the Russian people or the Russian leadership is, as an American experiencing aspects of Russian life, which were memorable and are the basis of the anecdotes. And I'm not in any way suggesting that's necessarily how Russians would see the same story. I'm an America in Russia that framed the lion's share of my experiences on Russia. We're actually living in Russia twice in the Soviet days and then after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So the puppet theater story, it was 1989 when I was in Moscow during the Soviet days, and I did take my young family, very small children, to the puppet theater. It was called the Gogol Puppet Theater in central Moscow. It was one of the few places, you know, really had children's entertainment. There weren't really many movies. Television was kind of bland in the Soviet days all the way to the collapse. But this was a really artistic, well-crafted show with puppet masters producing Russian fairy tales for the children.
And Rolf, do you remember how old your kids were?
Oh, yeah. My oldest was about 8 or 9, ten, and my youngest was 4. And were in the theater with all the other Russian children. I think we were the only foreigners. Of course, it was in Russian, but it was a lot of very visual, so my children could understand. And it's a fairy tale. And there's a prince and a princess, and the prince goes off to war, and he fights the war, and he goes through all these various hazards. You could see the children are screaming when he's almost killed in war, and then he's coming back to meet. His princess is on the left side of the stage, and he's on the right side of the stage waging the war with a kind of a sea or ocean in between. And finally, the war is over. And you can think when you hear this story about how many Russian wars there have been in their history, calamitous existential wars like Napoleon and Hitler and everything else in between. And he finally is coming back to his princess, and he crosses the ocean. One last hazard is a giant sea monster almost gets his ship, but they survive the perilous journey. And he gets to the shore, and his princess embraces him. The two puppets are locked in a loving embrace. And all along, I don't think anyone hardly probably noticed that there's this little black box in the corner in the left stage, black box in the shadows, and a light shines on it. And a giant jack-in-the-box, ugly, like clown-like creature with an evil face springs out of it, reaches down to the prince, grabs the prince while he's locked in an embrace, pulls him up, and pulls him into the jack-in-the-box, and the lid shuts tight with a slam.
Wow.
Then everything goes quiet. And the princess hangs her head as the light just goes back on her briefly, dimly now. And then a man walks on the stage dressed in all black. And he essentially, says, looks at the children, puts his finger out, little crooked finger, this I picture, imagine, remember it. And he says essentially to the children, just remember, children, that nothing in life is safe. Eventually, everything, will turn out bad. So be prepared for the worst things to happen in life. And the parents, the children, me, my wife, of course, we were all startled by the jack-in-the-box springing out just when the story seemed to be over. And it's a classic sad ending to the story, per most fairy tales. And it taught me that of the importance that Russians certainly place on preparing children for life's dangers and hazards, like we all try to do. And if you look at the traditions of fairy tales, that's exactly what they try to do with these terrible tales. Don't have the kids go in the forest, they might get lost, and those kinds of things. And here in the late 1980s, the Russians are still carrying on with that tradition.
How did your kids react compared to the Russian kids?
I think kids are kids, and they all react exactly the same way, right? And there's a lesson for every child in that. It doesn't have to be just Russian children. The idea that when you least expect it, life comes up with unexpected surprise, be prepared for it. It's actually, in a sense, it's an uplifting message in the sense of what the intention is, to prepare, to steel the children for life's hardships, which there have always been many hardships in Russian life. And it's a very dramatic thing, but that's the purpose of taking it to a puppet theater. So I think we had exactly the same reaction too, from shock to sadness.
And does it speak particularly to Russian history and the struggles they've had, as you mentioned?
Well, certainly I saw it that way, although you like to think when you're living as a diplomat in Russia, you are out in the streets, and we spent a lot of our time mingling and shopping and being out with the Russian people, trying to get a sense of their experience. At the end of the day, we're diplomats. We go back to our embassy. We're living a privileged, sheltered life. But you get a pretty good sense. And in those years, it was a very, I would call, formidable way to start our experience in Moscow, again, spanning two tours from before the collapse of the Soviet Union till after the collapse. I would say the experience was highlighted by a lot of uncertainty in the first part. Everyone knew something might happen. Things were crumbling. That was not a surprise to anyone. The suddenness of the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think, caught everyone by surprise, including the United States government, certainly the Russian Soviet government. And then afterwards, there's the rapid collapse of all the entire social support structure, any sense of social security, job security, pensions, healthcare, everything just went away almost overnight.
The second anecdote I want you to tell, Rolf, that you shared in the email chain is a 150-year-old box that your wife bought you in Moscow for your birthday. On the top of the box is a lacquer of Napoleon meeting with one of his key commanders, Marshal Ney, in Russia after the Battle of Borodino. Can you talk about that?
My wife knew that I was an avid collector, as she was. She collected things like clocks and carpets, and I collected Russian medals and lacquer boxes that sometimes called palak boxes. This happened to be from school called Fedoskino, and as you said, it was about 150 years old. It was a real prize box. It had the Tsar's seals inside, and it was she bought it for me for my birthday at an antique store, and she knew I would love the motif, which was this scene you describe, and Ney's reporting in a church outside the outskirts of Moscow after the Battle of Borodino in September 1812. And it was certainly, you know, the very definition of what we call a Pyrrhic victory. The Napoleonic army, La Grande Armée, defeated the Russian army. Mikhail Kutuzov, the marshal who led the Russian, brilliant general also, retreated. And rather than defend Moscow, he decided to continue east outside of Moscow and leave Moscow to Napoleon to occupy. When Napoleon went to occupy Moscow, the governor general of Moscow, a fellow named Fyodor Rostopchin, ordered per Kutuzov's orders, burn the Kremlin and burn most of the city, and most of the people left the city with the Russian army because the Russian army knew that they couldn't hold Moscow. So what they decided to do was embark on a scorched earth policy and not allow the French to gain any measure of victory by having won the Battle of Borodino. And sure, in fact, when Marshal Ney led the retreat of the army from Russia, over a third of this greatest army of the 19th century remained in Russia, as died, in other words, either in the battle or on the retreat. And it was pretty much the end of the French Empire. And when I look at the box, I still think about the biggest lesson I maybe learned in my time in Russia is the Russians are incredibly determined, resolute people to defend their own land, and whether it's Napoleon or Hitler, they're willing to burn their own capital down rather than give their enemy the satisfaction of occupying Russia.
Does it say anything to you, Rolf, about how Russia is thinking about Ukraine and may react in the months ahead?
When you began the podcast, you mentioned Russian mindset, which I take as a theme, essentially, of these anecdotes. And
yeah,
this Russian mindset is certainly present in everything they do. The idea that they will be defeated by their enemies is something that they have a history now that they have to live up to. And whether it's Vladimir Putin deciding how far to take the war in Ukraine, or what really is his war with the West, with the United States and NATO and the West, and Ukraine is the battlefield currently, but it's being played across a much broader battlefield, as we've talked about in past podcasts and everyone knows. And it's that context we need to always remember with Russia. If we're prepared to engage him, engage Russia, it's much bigger than one leader at one time of their history, then we have to be prepared to fight that battle to the very end, the bitter end.
Yeah. The third anecdote is an article that appeared in Newsweek about a year ago now, about 12 months ago. It was a former Putin speechwriter writing in Newsweek. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the article I sent you, Michael, and to our small group was by a Newsweek article by Abbas Galiamov, who for 3 years was a Putin speechwriter and left the country. And the article is an example of how important it is to understand psychology. He offers from his direct experience with Putin, what Putin wanted him to write, and what his observations of Putin over the years. He calls the original Putin to the Putin during the war in Ukraine. And it's not so important to understand, I think, his interpretation or analysis is the track he's on, which is to think of Putin as he thinks of himself as a leader, how he interacts with governors in Russia or his subordinates around him or his speechwriters. And he describes a lot of how Putin interacts with people and makes some observations. So the important, learning point for those of us who want to understand what's happening in Russia is to understand Putin as he sees himself, not as we see ourselves through him, or much less think of Russia as a country full of Americans led by a person we would describe as a despot and a dictator. How do Russians see him? Does he represent, espouse, defend their values? I'm sure that's a very complicated question, but that's the kind of question we have to work a lot harder at answering for ourselves to see. One that's commonly brought up, this article would make me think about is his religious beliefs and faith, and how we know, for example, that the Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, to be specific, is very supportive of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Why is that? Is that just because they have corrupt leaders in the church, or to what extent is religion an aspect of what Putin thinks he's trying to achieve with this war in Ukraine? Now, you can dismiss that and say, he's not a religious person. Oh, but first, we know in history how many evil things have been done in the name of religion, right?
Right.
And by all religions. And secondly, it's what's important to understand about Vladimir Putin's faith is what does he believe about God, not what do we think he believes through his actions. And that's what I think that article you cited reminds me of, is the importance of really getting deeply into the motivations, intentions, value proposition that leaders have that will motivate their decision making. And that's what we're trying to get at here, Michael, is how does Putin's value system and the things he believes he must defend affect his decision making, all the way up to potentially using, for example, nuclear weapons to defend Russia if it's necessary.
You know, one of the things that this discussion, Ralph, reminds me of is what you're describing is the fundamental responsibility of the CIA, right? It's not to say what we think is in the mind of a foreign leader or what that foreign leader might think. It's to actually know that, right? Whether you get at it analytically or whether much more effectively you get at it with humans, or you know, from a liaison perspective, by just spending time with these people. Some of the very best cables I read when I was a senior officer at CIA were chiefs of station who had spent 4 or 5 hours, you know, with a foreign counterpart, foreign leader, and just write up, right, their impressions of what made that person tick, and what made them assess that person ticking that way. I found those incredibly useful. So that's what this story reminds me of.
I agree, Michael, and it's of course it's wise on your part to take special note of that, because we don't get that many opportunities typically to have FaceTime or upfront time with the leaders or with the people who are close to leaders, many of them, and particularly the regimes or countries that we're most interested in. We have what we call, you know, hard target access to and denied area access. So oftentimes, unfortunately, our analysts have too little in-country experience, and then specifically not enough contact time with high-level leadership. And because of that, the temptation is to fill in the blank with other analysis or with more easily obtainable conclusions about what they're motivated by and what they're trying to. And by the way, their strengths and vulnerabilities. Vladimir Putin's like every other leader in the world. He has strengths and he has vulnerabilities. And it's to be very discerning about what those are and to point those out to our leadership is a critical part of leadership analysis.
You know, it occurs to me that that what an adversary is able to do depends on both their capabilities, right, and their intentions. And from an intelligence perspective, it is pretty easy to get a handle on capabilities, right? I mean, that's where technical intelligence comes in, that tells you, you know, what the capabilities are of a fighter or a tank or rocket system or what have you. It's the intentions that are very difficult to get at. And when there's a lack of hard intelligence, it forces the analyst to start speculating. And then that's when it gets very dangerous. It's my kind of long sense of what works and what doesn't work.
That's exactly right, Michael. You could use the example of, I always would say, because it's an area I've been following for decades, nuclear weapons programs around the world. And the more closed a country is, like North Korea or Iran, the intentions become, in a sense, the missing element, because we work overtime to try to assess what state the program's in, the capability. But if you take the case of Iran right now as we speak, it's all going to boil down to Iran's intentions, not their capabilities. We all are pretty much in analytical agreement. They're on the threshold of being a nuclear weapon state if they choose to. So it's placed even more importance on your most important point, which is that we have to understand what they intend and why they would want them and what would deter them from wanting them or using them.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Rolf.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Let me ask Rolf about another anecdote that you sent my way. It was a tweet from last September by a former senior Ukrainian Ministry of Intelligence official, a Ukrainian patriot, I should say, Anton Gerashenko. In the tweet, Gerashenko is quoting a Russian. What did he say in the tweet?
Yeah, I highlighted that and wanted to discuss it with all of us, because it refers to this very much the mindset, again, the psychology, almost the idiosyncratic, in this case, mindset of Russia specifically, of where grievances are so dominant, partially because of history, partially because of recent history. And I would say still the collapse of the Soviet Union is something particularly for Vladimir Putin and the few men who run Russia. They're never going to be free of that psychological, say, problem. But it's the idea of Russia's in a constant state of war, either preparing for war, in a war, or after a war, and dealing with the aftermath, and hasn't figured out in its governance model, and I think this is a fair statement. You can go way back in history back to the cycle that started with the Tsar, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Stalin period, World War II, and more recently Afghanistan, and now what we're facing, and then the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the idea that Russia's always in this upheaval of this cycle of war, and hasn't had neither a philosophy nor a lot of experience in managing a peacetime country to achieve its potential, whether it's artistic, economic, or progressive, you know, how Russia sees the future. Putin talks about it, interestingly enough. When he gives Valdai speeches, he likes to talk about Russian values. He likes to talk about what he wants to achieve for Russia's future. But he's ironically set Russia on this, I would call, disastrous course of continuing to perpetuate this Russian cycle. And right now they're again in war because they're most comfortable in war. And I think Putin certainly and the people closest to him believe they have to be in this war. This war was inevitable, and therefore they have to wage it. Now, of course, from my mindset, I would disagree with that. But I think it's important to understand that this cycle is very hard for the Russian leadership and then the Russian people to break.
You know, I was so taken with the story of the puppet show. That's why I asked about it first. But this preparing for war, in war, or you're dealing with the aftermath of war, and that's the entire reality, right? That puts the whole puppet show into context that makes perfect sense, right?
Yes, it really, I would say the puppet show, aside from preparation of children for life's hardship, it prepares people for children, as Putin now is preparing the Russian people for this tragedy that is Russia. And when he speaks of a more uplifting future that he hopes to have for the Russian people, almost everything he does cuts against that hope and desire. And certainly as a CIA officer and someone who spent enough time in Russia to truly empathize in many respects, I always loved Russian culture, history, poetry, everything else, writers. I empathize with the Russian people and wish the best for them. There's nothing that cuts against, from American interest, the desire to see Russians also have a good future. And so it is very tragic, I would say.
So the last anecdote that I want to ask about, Rolf, is a performance of the Nutcracker at a session late last year at the Bolshoi. Something special happens at the end of each performance when the Rat King dies. Can you share that? Maybe put in perspective for people what the Rat King is, because maybe not everybody has seen the Nutcracker.
Well, in the Nutcracker ballet, in the Bolshoi ballet, it's a famous one they've done for, of course, decades. You know, at the very end, the Rat King appears of the production. And the Rat King, I have to put this in some context. It didn't just come up randomly. I was asking a friend of mine who had recently seen a production in Moscow what he thought of Putin's popular appeal was. I haven't been back to Russia, certainly since the war and several years before the war. So I don't have a hands-on appreciation for how deep the public support is for the war in Ukraine and for Putin's continued leadership. My sense is, you know, again, maybe overstating my understanding of what's happening in Russia, tend to believe that it's not as strong as certainly the government presents or Putin would like to believe, but people are scared to death to oppose the war because they'll be jailed. And Putin's made it very clear that there's a stiff penalty to be paid for being disloyal or unpatriotic as he sees it with the war. So I look for these kinds of anecdotes to give me, you know, a sense of what's really going on. And a further context, Michael, is that back in the Soviet days, the other thing I liked to do is take my family to the circus. And all Russians know that you go to the circus, you get a nice, biting, political Saturday Night Live on steroids kind of sense of the satire in Russia from the clowns at the circus, because the clowns will act out all, and you will see personality, they'll assume government personalities and they'll assume the people they want to harpoon. And so this Bolshoi anecdote was meant in that same tradition, shall we say, of the old days. And Russians are nothing if not breathtakingly funny and dark humor about their own fortunes, like people all around the world. And they will find a way to express their true feelings. And this particular, the point of the story was when they get to the Rat King appearing in the ballet production, the entire audience rose and started cheering and clapping, meaning they were identifying the Rat King with Vladimir Putin, and that was the extension of the ballet to say political satire in today's Moscow, according to this person who was at the theater production.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, both the circus story and the ballet stories sound like Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, and I think so you look at one thing I've learned I haven't say a hobby in is looking at countries around the world, particularly dictatorship, authoritarian systems. You know how they treat comedy. For example, I love reading about the struggle of comedians in China because the regime has set an absolute limit on how far you can satirize, parodize, make parody of the regime, and they're currently in a crackdown because the more insecure a government is, the more they're going to crack down on comedians, right? Because you have to be pretty insecure to see comedy as a threat to you as a leader. I mean, I would like to think that if I were a leader, I'd be a little more self-assured than have to crack down on comedians. But also when people express themselves in those ways to show what they really think to the extent that's what was going on here, that's really interesting to observe.
Let me just finish up here, Rolf, by asking two questions, not about anecdotes, but other things that you have mentioned in our email discussions. One was a note you sent a few months ago. You were bemoaning the false moral, what you saw as the false moral equivalencies, and I certainly share the view, the false moral equivalencies that seem to be swirling around us on a daily basis, the false moral equivalency between Russia and Ukraine, between Putin and Zelensky, now between Israel and Hamas. What led you to think about that, to send the note, and where do you think those false moral equivalencies come from, and what do they portend? I'm afraid to ask that last question.
Yeah, I think it's a expansive question with a lot of parts, and just to touch on some of them. The reason I think so much about these days is because the sources of conflict in the world, whether it's war or what's causing wars and the conflicts that ultimately may lead to war, even in several years from now, are changing in this century than last. And they're driven by different factors. One is this assault on truth that's occurring in the world, where people don't seem to care if something's factually true or not. And once you don't believe in facts and truth, and you start to see that as a subjective ground that you can manipulate and twist, it becomes easy to justify causes. And to get a large chunk of the world, in the case of Russia, invading a neighboring country with no justification whatsoever, to believe something else, that it's not what it is. And this is exactly what happened in the 1930s, or pick another time in history. I won't speak to the scale and scope of the moral abyss that I see in the world when we don't defend truth and we don't defend facts. And the other thing is I attribute much of it to a crisis of identity in the world. And we see this playing out, for example, in Europe, where people are wondering, and we see it in the U.S., by the way, in American politics, we see it with our border problems, we see it with the immigration issues in Europe, we see this identity question, confusion. Some people are more comfortable living in their virtual reality identity that didn't exist before the internet and social media than they are in their real identity. And we're seeing people that are conflicted as to who they are. What does it mean to be in a tribe or a nation or of a different religion? And some people are becoming more extreme and trying to defend those feelings of identity, those traditional sense of identity. And others are frankly very willing to abandon them. So where do we find the harmony and the reconciliation in a world that's increasingly, I would say, moving towards individual conflict that reaches the level of causing wars, where you don't understand that you can support the Palestinian people and should be supporting the Palestinian, want an end to this war in Gaza, but not support Hamas.
Right.
Right. Just to use one example.
Yeah, for sure. Agree with you 100%. The second thing I want to ask about, Rolf, is maybe just spend a couple of minutes talking about where you see the war in Ukraine going. And the reason I ask is because in our conversations on our email chain, you've been quite pessimistic in the last several months. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Yes, I am pessimistic, and I attribute it to two main reasons. The first is the one that's most frustrating because I feel it's within our control. It's the lack of a U.S. strategic purpose in what we're trying to do to support Ukraine. What I mean by that is I don't know what the policy objective is. I've never heard of policy clarity, which then becomes problematic internally when the two parties split over the significance and importance of the U.S. defending democracy and defending the security of Europe and defending the principles that we've been defending since, frankly, the end of the Second World War about territorial integrity and international boundaries. So the fact that we seem to be finding it so difficult to come out with a clear moral purpose and we vacillate in weapons and then we don't give them and put Ukraine, frankly, in a horrible situation is really troubling for me as an American. The second reason, though, is I would say more numbers. I'm a huge baseball fanatic and love statistics.
I know.
And it kind of informs my thinking about the war. I don't see a way, as we look forward the next year or two in the war in Ukraine, where either side on the ground can win the war. Neither army has enough men or weapons or bullets to go on an offensive to get that 3-5-1 odds advantage that they would need to turn the tide on the battlefield, which means we're consigned to just a lot of misery and bloodshedding without a pathway to an equitable kind of solution, which I can't really even frankly articulate for you at this point because it involves almost certainly leaving Vladimir Putin in a seat where he doesn't need to go on an offensive in the next year or two. He can simply maintain the situation they're in, which it looks like the Russian military-industrial base is strong enough to keep pumping out the tanks, artillery, bullets to sustain what the Russians are doing, maybe even increase the tempo a little bit. But ultimately, Russia's got a huge problem with mobilization too. But Ukraine's is bigger. Yeah. And while I salute, applaud, and don't want in any way to discourage Ukraine from finishing the war in a more favorable terms, I don't see how they can gear up an industrial military establishment to produce the kinds of weapons nor mobilize to the extent they can overcome the deficit they have compared to the Russians. And that's just going to be a numbers problem that I don't think leadership is going to solve if you change a general or you change a president or you change those kinds of things or U.S. aid comes back, which I hope it does. I still don't see that as turning the tide in this war. There has to be a strategic switch of some sort that I can't imagine right now. So I'm pessimistic.
So I don't want to leave us on a pessimistic note here. So the Super Bowl is this coming Sunday. Who's going to win?
Oh, the hardest question for last.
The hardest question. This is, yes.
Well, we've talked about this, right?
Yes, we have.
I'm actually going to go with the Chiefs because of Mahomes.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go with my gut. Yeah. I think the odds favor a little bit the 49ers, just the system and fantastic team also. Both two great teams on the field, but I'll go with the Chiefs. How about you, Michael?
Me too. I think Mahomes is Brady-like, and I think he will find a way to win at the end of the day. So Chiefs by 3 or 4.
All right. I'll sign up with that. Double
okay.
pump.
Rolf, great to have you with us. Great stories. Thank you for unpacking what it all means. Great to have you on the show again.
Glad to be back, Michael.
That was Rolf Moet Larsen. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And please don't forget to rate and review Intelligence Matters wherever you get your podcasts.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.